I'm Dick Gordon, live from Baghdad. This is The Connection.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
In the shimmering heat of the midday sun, the imam stands at the center of his mosque's inner courtyard, delivering the traditional call to prayer. And it sounds more like it did hundreds of years ago, because Baghdad is still without electricity. The loudspeakers wired to the minaret are useless. This hour, we focus on the growing power of Muslim leaders in Iraq. For in a country now without a leader, still with no government and no signs of any civil authority, people have turned to their sheikhs and their imams, not just for guidance, but also for safety, for water, food, and medicine. As the aspiring secular leaders jockey for favor with American advisors, and as they bicker over sharing power, the mosques and the churches already have that power. What will this mean for the future of such a diverse nation? Is Iraq destined to a future more like Iran or other Islamic states, where clerics help determine policy and law? Will the old rivalries between Shiite and Sunni divide this nation? Our number, Connection listeners, is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I put these questions to the imam delivering this call to prayer. He is Hasim Naim. He is Sunni. In comparison to others, his people fared relatively well under Saddam Hussein, who was himself a Sunni.
لا والله ليس عندي لكن في الحقيقة صراحة يعني بصراحة كثيرة أو كبيرة يعني.
When Saddam Hussein was ruling Iraq, he says, although he used to treat people cruelly, we did feel safe. But right now, and after what has just happened, we don't have the kind of security that we had under Saddam Hussein. I then asked him if he was worried that Shiite and Sunni leaders might not get along as they did in the past.
أي والله جدا قلق جدا قلق ونحن الآن نخشى مخاطر مستقبلية.
Yes, he said, I am worried, but we are worried about another movement that is trying to divide Sunni and Shia. He went on to talk about infiltrators from Iran who will try to force this division. And the Sunni imam does have cause to be concerned. I went also to the Shiite quarter of Baghdad. I found Sheikh Samil al-Bindawi. He is a senior Shiite cleric. But when I found him, he was directing a large red and white fire truck, delivering water. Now, it's important to know that while the Shia were severely oppressed under Saddam Hussein, they are still the majority here. They outnumber the Sunni more than 2-1. Sheikh Samil says it's about time the clerics regained the authority that they have lost. He'd like to see a new Iraq where clerics had much more say.
يعني هسه احنا نشوف انه افضل البلدان الموجوده هي بلاد ايران ولكن هاي توقعات ما رجم من الغيب لا نعلم.
Iran, he says, is the best example, the best I can see right now. There, the politicians and the clerics cannot operate independently. They rule together. Here, he says, I still don't know what will happen. One more piece of the puzzle, and that is the Christians, though their numbers are small and dwindling. Barbir Hagopian is secretary of the Central Committee of Armenians in Iraq and a leader in the Armenian Orthodox Christian Church. He says he is confident that this country will not splinter into feuding clerics and fundamentalism.
We are not afraid from such things because Iraq is not Iran. Iraq is something else. We in Iraq have lived for 1,000 years, Muslims as Shiites and Sunnis as Christians, brotherly. I think they will solve these things there will not be any problem. Now, of course, everything has changed. Everybody is speaking. They are talking. They are doing. Everybody says things that he likes. But lately, everything will be solved and everything will be settled. We think like that.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am sure. I am sure. Because I believe in the Iraqi people. I believe that there are Arabs, Kurds, and everything. And for years we were living brotherly. It is true that they didn't like Saddam Hussein or the regime was like that. But the regime changes. Now changed. We hope everything will be better. It will be better.
Barbir Hagopian is with me here in our Baghdad studio, and I want to thank you for joining us on what's such an important day in your religious calendar. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Now, you had a chance, Barbir, to hear what the Muslim clerics were saying, and I can imagine there would be some questions or some concern from among the members of your congregation. Are there people in the church who are worried about the future?
Of course, everybody in Baghdad is worried. Well, the situation is not so good now. But we think, as Armenians and as Christians, this whole problem will be solved, and will be solved in very near future. Because we saw so many bad things.
And will that solution come from politicians, or will it come from church and mosque leaders meeting together?
Well, I think mostly it will come from Muslims themselves and, of course, the politicians. They must help one each other. And they will do. As I said, Iraq is not like other countries. Every time when they had, in the past, any problem, they could solve it. And it was solved.
We are also joined by Dr. Hamid Dabashi. He is Columbia University Department Chair in Persian Literature and Sociology of Culture, author of a number of books on Iran, and he's actually joining our program this hour from an NPR studio in New York City. Dr. Dabashi, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Good morning. Well, good afternoon to you, Lada.
Tell me, if you would, your thoughts on what you were hearing in the beginning of the program from the religious leaders here. What are you thinking?
Well, I of course certainly share Mr. Hakupian's hope that Iraq will not go Iran's way, that Iraq is in fact a different country in many respects. But I also believe that there are many similarities between post-Saddam Hussein in Iraq and Muhammad Reza Pahlavi in Iran. In fact, historically, we have a bizarre situation of reciprocity. Right now, one of the leading Shi'i clerics, Iraqi Shi'i clerics, Ayatollah Hakim, is in exile in Iran, which replicates the exile of Ayatollah Khomeini in Najaf, exactly 2.5 decades ago, when he went back to Iran to lead the Islamic Revolution. So I do share his hopes for Iraq that religious differences and sectarian differences will not affect its future, but I'm a bit more afraid than he.
Are you, when you make the comparison between Iran in 1979 when the Ayatollah, well actually it was a little bit before 79 I guess, but between that time and this moment in Iraq, are you saying that there is a risk, or that you are already beginning to see some kind of sort of reaching out for the power that is simply not being held by anyone else?
I believe there is already a reaching out for power, which we saw it in the absolutely ghastly murder of one of the most prominent and most distinguished excuse me, Shia authorities in Najaf, in the holiest shrines of in the Shia community, and that is an indication that already a struggle for power has emerged, not only among the Shia communities, various factions within the Shia communities itself, but also among other sectarian and ethnic divisions within Iraq. I think the battle for power has already started.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to have you join our conversation about the role of religion in these crucial moments in Iraq. And I want to turn back to my Baghdad studio guest, Barvir Hagopian, because I think it's probably useful for us to have a clearer idea of what life was like for you under Saddam Hussein. He made a point of saying out loud that he was not going to bother the Christians, that he was not going to tell the Shia or the Sunni what to do. But in the latter years of Saddam Hussein's time, he did become a more religious man, or at least he projected a more religious image of himself. He even named a mosque after himself.
Well, everybody knows that our ex-president Saddam Hussein, he was not religious one. Then he changed to be religious, and he started to build mosques and to pray. He goes everywhere to pray. But you see, whole Islam world started to be changed, not Iraq only. Well, they all, everybody was going to religion.
And so he was just following that trend.
Well, of course, it was like that.
Dr. Dabashi, just a quick one from you, if I can, and that is, there is a traditional role for the mosque in providing comfort for people in times of difficulty, for providing medicine and food and shelter, in fact, acting almost as a welfare state. Is what we're watching and what you're hearing about in Baghdad similar to that now, or do you see the clerics actually reaching beyond that to some sort of political power?
It's a combination of both, Mr. Gordon. As you rightly said, mosques have historically provided a haven for safety, especially under these circumstances, there is no public safety, and some of the most precious monuments of Iraqi culture have been sacked, as you know, that the safety is non-existent, and in fact, we hear that civilian protesters have been shot at lately. That mosques, Sunni mosques, Shi'i mosques, as well as, I might add, churches and synagogues, provide safety and haven. But at the same time, this is the struggle for power in Iraq has started. So it's a combination of both political, as it has always been in the history of Islam, a combination of both social and political, religious and political factors coming together in this particular case.
All right. Connection listeners, as Iraq stumbles into a future without a leader, without a government, what are the possibilities that Muslim clerics will assume a greater and greater role in administering the country? And for more on our guests, please check our website at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special edition of The Connection live from Baghdad. Earlier today, I was in the Saddam Children's Hospital. 3.5-year-old Dalia Ali was in for a blood transfusion that had been dangerously delayed by the war. The medical staff is busy, frantic, still dealing with gunshot wounds. At the other end of the emergency ward, Dr. Hasim Rahim Issa was talking, not to patients, but to a gathering of Shiite clerics. They had come to the hospital, said Dr. Hasim, to tell the medical staff that if they want anything, volunteers, medicine, they should come first to the mosque.
As you know, we have no government, no police, no policeman. There's some criminal people outside. So we must depend on trust people. And the mosque, they are trust people.
So they're here to help you, to give you advice, to give you money, to give you assistance?
And it's all together.
All of that?
All of that. Help, money, advice, medicines.
You would be in real trouble without the help of the mosque now.
Yes. We are alone. So if we don't help them, we'll lost our hospital.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Connection listeners, an opportunity for you to participate in a program looking at the change that is currently underway in Iraq. We're talking about the religious circumstances, the way that the churches and the mosques have been forced to move into a power vacuum created by the sudden departure of Saddam Hussein, the collapse of his government, and the chaos that is in not only this capital city but across the country here. I have with me on the program Barvir Hagopian. He is secretary of the Central Committee of Armenians in Iraq, also a leader of the Armenian Orthodox Church. Dr. Hamid Debashi is with us. He's department chair in Persian Literature and Sociology of Culture at Columbia University, author of a number of books, among them Authority in Islam and Theology of Discontent, the Ideological Foundation of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And Dr. Debashi, I'd like to turn to you first, if I could, because I want to pluck from what the doctor was saying a word that I think is so key here. He said that the people in the mosque are trust people. He meant trustworthy people. And
exactly.
And surely at this point, the whole idea that those are the only people trust will have a lot to do with deciding what happens next.
Absolutely. They are resorting to their most sacrosanct pieties and civil institutions, non-governmental institutions that have been there and have been ready to help them historically. And in the absence of any government and in the presence of an occupied army and in the decimation of their monuments of their national culture, people are shocked, Mr. Gordon. It's extremely important to understand that you are right now in Baghdad and to understand the state of shock and awe that we heard here at the commencement of this war. That people are in that state. And also, they are just beginning to emerge from a prolonged dictatorship. There is no civil society. There is no political party. There is no other alternative to existing networks of mosques and historical relationship between Shi'i leaders and Sunni leaders and Christian and Jewish leaders and their community. People are resorting back almost in the aftermath of a postmodern war to medieval institutions that have always existed to help them.
And Barvir Hagopian, tell me whether or not in the Armenian Orthodox Church, people are also coming to your bishop, to your leaders, and saying, we need more from you now. We need you to be our leaders as well.
Well, we don't have such thing. We don't have. Our people, just sometimes they need some help, money or food, we provide them. But you see, we Armenians in Iraq, we don't seek leadership. We don't have such problems. We are a very small minority.
But that's the point worth looking at, though, because you are a small minority. There will be, at some point, a need for you and your church leaders to know that you will be protected, that you will be left alone, that you won't be in any way discriminated against for being Christians in a country that is so predominantly Muslim.
Well, as I said, in the past, we didn't have any problem living with Muslims. You saw yesterday at our church, our guards are Muslims. In the church, we have guards, Muslims. They are guarding our church. As I said, in the past, we didn't have any problem. And we think and we are sure we will never have any problems with Muslims. For years we have lived, not in Iraq only, in the whole Muslim world, the Christians didn't have any problem. And
but it
especially Armenians, we didn't have any problems.
But it hasn't been a great life. Many Christians have left Iraq over the last...
Well, that is not only for religious purposes.
It's more quality of life, is it?
Well, quality of life. You see Saddam Hussein and his regime. That was very good, very, very big problem for our people.
Dr. Dabashi, what will the people in Iran, what will the religious leaders there be watching now? When the Sunni imam spoke earlier in the program about infiltrators from Iran, was he being accurate? Is it a fair word?
That's a very important question, Mr. Gordon. But if I may say something about the comment of Mr. Hakupian, I, of course, strongly second his judgment that Armenian communities have lived in the area for a very long history peacefully with their Muslim neighbors and thrived in both economically and socially and so forth. But again, I must remind all of us that the Armenian genocide also took place in the Ottoman Empire. And as a result, the significance of the question you raised, namely the constitutional safety and rights of minorities such as Armenians in any post-Saddam Hussein government, is extremely important. This is not to negate Mr. Harkoopian's correct assessment that in Iraq, Armenians have lived historically very peacefully with their Muslim neighbors. And again, as he suggested, Muslim Iraqis are not protecting churches and synagogues from looters and thieves. But here we are in the process of nation building and hopefully the writing of a constitution. And it is extremely important for the Armenian community, as well as all other religious and ideological minorities in Iraq, to have constitutional protection for their future. As for the infiltration from the Iranian side, I think what we are witnessing today can have catalytic effect both on Iran and on Iraq. We have to keep in mind that right now in Iran we have an ideological civil war between progressive elements around President Khatami and also on one side, and on the other side very retrograde elements who are strong supporters of an Islamic Republic and an elimination of all civil and human rights within an Islamic Republic. Now, it all depends what the configuration of the post-Saddam Hussein power in Iraq will be. If we have a secular constitutional democracy in Iraq, obviously it will feed on similar sentiments and institutional developments in Iran. On the other hand, the right-wing religious forces in Iran will have a heyday if, in fact, they will succeed in creating a similar Islamic Republic in Iraq, and in my judgment will be catastrophic both for Iraq and for Iran. That is close to a decade and a half of very gradual baby step progress towards institutionalization of democracy in Islamic Republic of Iran without bloodshed, with much bloodshed, or without any revolution, will be totally decimated if we have an Islamic Republic or any form of religious theocracy in Iraq. Iraq is in an extremely important historical position, in fact, not only to help Iran to successfully emerge from this period of trial and tribulations that is still constitutionally caught in a theocracy, but very, very gradually.
Dr. Dabashi, let me interrupt you there because we have a number of people who'd like to join us on the telephone. I'm going to go first to Hossam, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Hossam.
Yeah, hi, Dick. I just wanted to make the comment that I'm getting the impression that there's a negative connotation when we're talking about the Islamic clerics taking power and all that. I just want to say that historically, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, the church was very hard on the people. And it came to the point where the people said, enough, we need separation of church and state. And that is the origin of it, where the church was burning people for saying the earth is round, for example. There was a conflict between science, religion, and politics. In Islam, in the East, we never had that. There's always been a balance between science, politics, and religion. So I don't see anything wrong with clerics or religious leaders taking power in Iraq.
I'm not sure that the negative implication may be in tone, and if it is, you're welcome to point to that. What I'm interested in hearing from you, Hossam, is your sense of what you think is going to happen. You've listened to the people speak. You know the situation in Iraq. You know the desperate uncertainty that people are feeling, and the fact that they're turning to their religious leaders in the same way that people in America would turn to a Christian church in a time of great tragedy. So where do you think it leads this country, though? That's the point.
Here in America, for example, the people will go to the church, yes, for solace and all that. But in the Islamic, in the Middle East, we go for religious reasons, but also we go for political reasons. Personally, I wouldn't see any problem with an Islamic government, for example. I don't think it's going to go towards that, but I won't see any problem with that.
Dr. Dabashi, do we have any current example of a secular government working hand in glove with Muslim clerics? Do we look at Pakistan? Do we look at Indonesia? Do we look at anywhere where the type of rule that Hossam is talking about is viable?
I think I agree with Hossam that he raises an extremely important question, that history of Islamic societies, both medieval and modern, should not be assimilated to European history or American history. This is a very important point. However, the necessity of a pluralistic society and a secular constitution, secular in a very broad sense, in which all religion, obviously in a country that 60% of its population is Shi'i, particularly Shi'i community, will have a free and open and without any hindrance practices of the religion, does not necessarily have to be in the form of an Islamic government. I strongly recommend to Hossam to consider the history of Islamic Republic over the last 2.5 decades, that in fact all forms of civil society, all forms of inalienable human rights have been systematically disregarded. And what is emerging in most recent history after the election of Khatami, it is not a negation of Iran as an Islamic society. It is a profound emphasis on Iran and as Islamic society. But both politically and socially, we are moving towards a conception of pluralism and tolerant society, that there is not the sharp separation of church and state, as Hossam rightly warns us that this is a specific historical circumstances, but in a way that dictates of medieval jurisprudence does not politically govern the livelihood of a modern society.
Hossam, let me hear from you again on this.
I agree with what he's saying. My only disagreement is the point that, yes, maybe the past 2.5 decades, it hasn't been working correctly. But I don't think this has to do with Islam, or I think mainly it's just not being applied correctly. The people are just going towards their own personal gain or greed, and Islam as a religion and a political system is not being applied, put simply. Because I think in the past, in history, in mankind's history, it had been applied at a certain point, and it did succeed at that point. Since then, I don't think we have achieved it, as the talker rightly said.
I want to turn to Barbier Hakopian here in Baghdad, because you have watched the push and the pull of religion in countries around Iraq. When you say that Iraqi people know how to get along together, is it fair to say that they only got along together because there was a very powerful, strong-armed leader saying, you have no choice but to do this?
Well, no. I think the Iraqi people, you see, the Iraqi people are mostly Arabs and Kurds. Don't forget that there are Kurds. There are Chaldeans. Of course, they are Christians. Well, the formation of Iraqi people, of course, in the future,
the leaders, the politicians, when they put the constitution, they must take into consideration this form. While they must not forget that there are Kurds, there are Christians, there are Sunnis and Shiites.
And all these people need to be...
Of course, they must take into consideration this point. Well, that is the point that we believe that everything will be settled in near future. Although all the world are worried about, and as I heard doctor said, but it will be solved.
You are an optimistic man. Hamid Debashi, let me just hear a bit from you about how we might see this play out. Because, of course, it's often said that it is the poor people looking for guidance without the intellectual knowledge of history from anywhere that who are likely to follow religious leaders. And in your study of this in Iran, will these decisions that we're talking about be made in the lower classes or the upper classes?
Well, there is a fundamental difference between the Iranian case and the Iraqi case, which is Iraq right now is under military occupation. And the problem that now we face is how anybody who comes close to this military occupation gets brutally assassinated. And under these circumstances, there is no fluent and legitimate conversation between the masses and their leaders. To me, this is not the $64,000 question. How are we going to have a conversation between Shiis and Kurds and Sunnis? And also, another important point is that Iraq is also a strong nationalist society, and there are socialist elements. The religious factors are not alone. So that remains our fundamental problem.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The future of the religions in Iraq, how they will find their way with or beside or over top of or in link with the politics. We'd like to hear your thoughts. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special edition of The Connection live from Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special edition of The Connection live from Baghdad. About 4 hours ago, this was the sound at the St. Garabit Armenian Orthodox Church. Bells were ringing, calling parishioners to the special service that is normally held every Holy Thursday in the evening. But because of the situation in Baghdad, because of the fact that there is no electricity and no street lighting and it's dangerous to be out in the dark, this service was held in the bright of the afternoon, just an idea of the way that the different religions have to adapt to the circumstances that people in Baghdad and in Iraq are undergoing right now. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, in this hour a conversation about the religious future of this country and what role religion will play in determining the political future of Baghdad. We're going to go straight back to our calls. Fareed is on the line from Cambridge. Fareed, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, Dick, and I wish I were with you. I was originally born in Baghdad, and there are a few things I'd like to say, but I'll focus on the topic of the conversation, which is the future of the role of religion in Iraq. I've noticed that your speakers, and generally amongst many commentators, people tend to be somewhat reductive when describing the religious landscape in Iraq. They do acknowledge that there are many communities, one of them is dominant, at least numerically, but they tend to display them as being monolithic. And in fact, it is not so, not at all, particularly among the Shia. As your guests might know, there are, in fact, two dominant schools of thought within the Shia creed. One is being promoted by the Hu'is and the Sistanis, Ali Sistani being the highest living authority, which is in favor of a separation of church and state, not in order to ensure the independence of religion from state. The other, of course, is Ayatollah Baqir al-Hakim, who heads the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, who leans more towards the solution, sort of Iranian style, although in recent years, I think...
Fareed, you clearly know a lot about this. I'm interested in hearing from you whether or not you think that there will be, from among those two groups, though, not a push for greater power, particularly given the oppression that the Shiite have been suffering under Saddam Hussein.
Well, there undoubtedly will be. I mean, you've seen it. There are assertions of the will to exert political power or influence, at least on the affairs that have impact on themselves, on the communities themselves. Particularly, one particular signature of that is the religious ceremonies, ceremonials that have been taking place, that have been described most by Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post. I don't know if you've read his articles.
No, my post doesn't get delivered to my hotel here in Baghdad, but I was looking at some of it before. No, I'm kidding. I'd like to actually hear from Dr. Hamid Dabashi on the point you're making about what happens internally within the Shia community, because I think, Fareed, you make a very, very good point that in storytelling terms, we do tend to oversimplify things. Hamid.
I absolutely second Fareed's very, very important intervention. The division that now is emerging is a classical division. I wouldn't say characterize Khoi Sistani category as apolitical. They're more juridically oriented. That is, they're very concerned about Shi'i communities, the sanctity of Shi'i shrines, etc. Whereas both, not only Ayatollah Hakim, who is Iran-based, but the son of a very prominent Shi'i cleric who was murdered by Saddam Hussein in 1980, now has emerged as a contender, as a political contender. And in fact, there are rumors. Nobody knows who murdered Khoi, but one rumor is that he or his band is responsible. What we ultimately need to keep in mind that, yes, there will be a over-politicized faction within the Shi'i community, and then a Shi'i community that will think about this in long terms, safety of the Shi'i community and the sanctity of the Shi'i shrines. The son of Ayatollah Khoi, who was just murdered in Najaf, his father was one of the most noble and the most respected Ayatollahs until his death. And right now they have established a foundation in London. That foundation, after the death of his son, will not, I don't believe, I think he made a strategic mistake of affiliating himself with this occupying army. But the foundation will not disappear, will continue to have a central role to play, but it will not be political role, it would be a social role, that is, in terms of their foundation and institutions that are under their control, endowments and religious taxes that are due to them, and pious Shi'is pay them regularly. So my estimation is that these are dire circumstances, and as a result, political Shi'ism will take over for the short period, but for the long period, again, Shi'i institutions will continue to cater to the more enduring elements.
Hamid, you might be interested to know that part of Baghdad, which for years has been known as Saddam City, where many of the Shiite Muslims live in this part of Baghdad, there's a great big banner across that traffic circle leading to that part of town now, and it says, this is now city of al-Sadr,
exactly.
Named after the grand Ayatollah Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, who was, I think, killed in 1999 by Saddam Hussein, along with his two sons in Najaf. So your point about the politics always being in many ways so close to the surface is key here.
Exactly.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Saeed, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Saeed.
Oh, hi. Yeah, the point I wanted
You're
to
on,
make,
go ahead.
Okay. Is that when we have a free election in Iraq, when we have people freely going to vote, we shouldn't be worried about if they're going to choose religious leaders.
Saeed, I wonder if I, Saeed, let me just interrupt you and ask you to turn your radio off because we're getting an echo from you.
Okay. Is it better now?
Thank you very much. Yeah, okay. Go ahead, please.
So what I'm saying is that when we have a free election, a democratic election in Iraq, if people go and vote freely, we shouldn't be worried about if they're going to choose religious leaders or if they are not going to choose religious leaders. Whatever they will, whatever they wish, is going to be there. And if it's a religious government, it's going to be that way. Second thing I wanted to say very fast is
so wait a second. What are you saying, that it's just a question of majority rule? I mean, I was talking to somebody in the formerly Saddam city who said they will only choose the person who the sheikh tells them to vote for.
I don't agree with that. I do not agree with that. The fact that I trust, I like a religious leader, the fact that I trust a religious leader doesn't mean that if I have the ministry of, let's say, economy, and you give me a PhD in economy, I'm gonna choose the religious leader over him. I mean, that's a simple matter, which you can see in Iran, that people are going after experts, and at the same time, they might have a good relationship with some religious leaders and things like that. Secondly,
let me just interrupt you if I can, Saeed, because I'm interested in hearing from Barbir Hagopian here. Do people in the Christian community fear the tyranny of one man, one vote in Iraq, where the numbers of the Christian community would be less than 5%? Is this an issue that people are concerned about or not?
Oh, they are not. No.
I mean, there will be, most likely, an Arab president of Iraq, almost certainly a Muslim Arab president of Iraq.
Yes, of course. It was always like that. This country was ruled by Arab leaders. There were Sunnis. That is the reason why Sunnis and Shiites are a little bit... because the Sunnis are minority. I mean the Shiites are more than Sunnis. But always the leaders... I mean, the president, before that the king, they all were Sunni. And the government mostly was Sunni. This made some problems. Now I think they will consider this.
And?
They must consider this. So in the future, they will not have any problems.
Hamid, tell me what you think a vote might produce in this country.
Well, obviously I'm all for votes and for democracy, but here at this particular juncture in Iraqi history, we are faced with obvious problems of institution building, writing of a constitution in which balances of power are established, in which rights and privileges of religious minorities and political minorities and rights of women. In particular, I wish you had somebody among your guests who will address that issue, are protected and written into the Constitution. Democracy is an ideal to which we all appeal, but democracy also has the possibility of degenerating into very dangerous populism. And when you look at the cast of characters who have either gathered in Baghdad or about to gather in Baghdad, you really don't see any legitimate figure that has emerged from any social movement or revolutionary movement that commands the respect of the Iraqi people. And this is an extremely dangerous circumstance in which demagogues or politically ambitious people can come to the fore and abuse the possibilities of democracy. I think right now, as I said, the problem we face, that the only difference between Iraq and Iran is that Iran was, for better or for worse, was the result of a massive social revolution. And a constitutional assembly was soon established. Of course, the Islamists, through the American hostage crisis, sabotaged the democratic possibilities of it and wrote an Islamic constitution that, you know, we are still stuck with it. But in Iraq, we don't have that problem. We have a different problem, which is the problem of who can legitimately convene such a constitutional assembly.
Who has
certainly
the trust?
Not exactly. Certainly not Zalmay Khalilzad, the President Bush's envoy to Iraq. He has absolutely no political, moral legitimacy to convene such a gathering.
Barbara, can you imagine an Iraq at some point in the future where you have political leaders, but you also have religious leaders, Sunni and Shia, who have a greater role in society, more to say in terms of setting social policy and perhaps even some legal policy?
Well, I think it won't happen in Iraq. It won't happen that in Iraq. No, because, as I said, the construction of Iraqi people is not like Iran. Iran is a country, the whole people are Shiites, very minority Sunnis. Here is something else. And here we have the Kurds. The Kurds are, they want their constitution to be more European, like Europeans.
Let me just stop you there. And Hamid, a last word from you. Are we at that particularly critical juncture right now in Iraq?
For what?
For establishing what kind of political change, what kind of religious power we'll see in the future.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, with all due respect to Father Hakoubian, I will remind him that there are twice as many Kurds in Iran as there are in Iraq. There are 10 times as many Armenians in Iran as there are in Iraq. And it is now time for the rights. I cannot repeat it enough, for the right constitutional rights of the minorities and balance of power and writing of
Hamid,
the Constitution.
Hamid, I want to stop you there and thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Hamid Dabashi is Department Chair in Persian Literature. Barvir Hagopian, thank you so much for coming in.
Don't mention it.
Barvir is Secretary of the Central Committee of Armenians in Iraq. Please, Connection listeners, take a chance to go to our website. We are at theconnection.org. You'll see photographs of our guests and places that we've talked about on the program today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, live from Baghdad. حي على الصلاة حي على الفلاح حي على الفلاح